Regis Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
The greatest day begins with Kerry's inaugural All-Ireland Senior Football Championship success, that of the 1903 season. The campaign was also notable for the trilogy that secured the future of the Gaelic Athletic Association. Throughout this programme, we'll be reproducing extracts from the Kerry Sentinel newspaper of that era, with Gary O'Sullivan bringing life to those words of over a century ago.
Part 1.
As county champions of 1902, Tralee Mitchells had the honour of representing Kerry for the 1903 campaign. Whereas in the early years of All-Ireland competition, one club represented a county, by the turn of the century, clubs were permitted to call on outside players to aid their cause. In the course of the 1903 season, Mitchells featured players from five other sides: Killarney Crokes, Castle Island, Lone Rangers, Tarbert and Carras Eivean. 1903 saw the first year of the Tour de France. Also around that time, Henry Ford formed the Ford Motor Group, while the Royal Cork Yacht Club hosted the world's first powerboat race. The first flight of a motorised aeroplane in Europe took place in France, while severe storms and floods hit Ireland. Football in the early 1900s was 17-a-side. The early years of the 20th century saw the emergence of the war cry, Up Kerry. Supporters of the county team had adopted the slogan, Up Bailey, from campaigners for county council election candidate Ballymac's James Bailey. It may have been the 1903 season that Kerry won the All-Ireland for the first time, but it was 1905 before the final actually took place. It was commonplace at the time for championships to run behind schedule, and this one was no different. GAA historian Tom Looney believes there were a variety of reasons why an association, still in its relative infancy, had problems completing its programme of matches on schedule.
I think a lot of the reason would be administration. Like, the association had very little money, you know, in those days. They hadn't the money to organise things. You had a lot of objections. Objections held everything up. You had troubles in a lot of county boards, including our own Kerry County Board, and this would hold up things. And then you see it was the club team represented the county, and if the county championship wasn't finished, you didn't have a county representative to go on to represent the county. So things weren't as tightly organised as they are now. Maybe it was an easier going age as well, you know.
The 1903 campaign began against Waterford, with the Kerry side including soon-to-be household names such as Roddy Kerwin, Maurice McCarthy, Austin Stack and Jim and Thady O'Gorman. One name that did not feature in the 4-8-1-3 victory over Waterford was Dick Fitzgerald, who would go on to wear the number 13 jersey for the rest of the season. The legend of the contribution of a teenage Dick Fitz to Kerry's success of that season has grown throughout the decades. However, Tom Looney, in his biography of Fitzgerald, titled King in a Kingdom of Kings, exposed that myth.
Dick Fitzgerald was born in College Street in Killarney on the 2nd of October, 1882. And I've checked this with the cathedral in Killarney. The reason I checked this out at all is there are a lot of myths actually surrounding the birth date of Dick Fitz, or he was called Dick Ian, or Richard Fitzgerald. And in local folklore, he was still down as the youngest ever person to win All-Ireland senior football, which is not quite true. Even his family, when he died, Lord have mercy on him, put down the wrong date as well on the monument, you know. So in fact, like, he was born in 1882, not 1884, or sometimes 1886. I suppose there was a lot of myth and legend surrounding him, and Dick was a very humorous kind of guy. I think he never corrected those little misconceptions about his date, so he didn't mind being regarded as younger than he really actually was, you know.
In his 1963 interview with the Irish Press, Denny Breen of Castle Island stated that Breen himself, aged 21, was the youngest member of that season's winning side. Eugene O'Sullivan of Crokes and Tarbert's Paul F. Hayes both played in the 1903 opener against Waterford, their only appearance of that campaign. For the Munster semi-final against Clare, the aforementioned Denny Breen and Dick Fitz were selected. In the first half hour against Clare,
Kerry pressed and, with the wind in their favour, scored 2 goals and 5 points to Clare's nil. In the second half, the Clare men pulled themselves together and 7 minutes after resuming play scored 2 goals. The match then became a give and take one, and at the final whistle, the score stood Kerry 2 goals, 7 points, Clare 2 goals.
It's worth noting that the press coverage afforded to the GAA in the early 1900s was vastly different to what we've become accustomed to in more recent times. More often than not, games were only afforded a few paragraphs, although this increased as the season progressed. However, on occasions, there were no reports on games, merely results published. Also, records were not as readily kept as in later years, leading to discrepancies in match accounts. The victory over Clare set up a Munster final clash with Cork. John Buckley played his first game of the season. So too did his fellow Mitchell's man, Con Healy, as well as Billy Lynch of Crokes and Castle Island's T. Sugrue. Mitchell's pair, E. Hannafin and Jim O'Connell, along with Mike Joy of Lawn Rangers, were dropped and would not play again that season. Kerry easily disposed of Cork, 1-7 to 3 points, in a game which was proclaimed as
a splendid one. In fact, one of the best that has ever been played for the Munster Championship. Kerry outplayed Cork from start to finish. Their passing was better, and their combination could not be surpassed. Each man played as if on him alone depended the winning of the game. Kerry were the favourites prior to the match, and it is needless to say, after their very substantial win, that the confidence of their admirers was not misplaced.
The Rebels may have opened the scoring, but it was relatively one-way traffic from then on.
Cork came on with a brilliant dash, and Hillard sent in a point for Cork. A free to Kerry immensely improved their position, and at the outcome of a fierce tussle, O'Gorman secured the leather and brought off a minor score, thus equalising. From a centre, Kerry were given a free, and in the tussle, O'Gorman again availed of an opening and placed the second point to the credit of Kerry. Still maintaining the pressing tactics, another minor was registered for Kerry by Duggan per Ryan. Soon after, a chance offered for Kerry, and Sugrue registered a further minor for the representatives of the kingdom. The defence raised by Kerry was most effective, and they finally charged into Cork's ground successfully, another minor going down to Kerry. A leading feature of the play was the blocking tactics set up by Kerry. Scarcely had a Corkman got possession when he was charged down and his kick intercepted.
Kerry's domination at both ends gave them a 5 points to one half-time advantage. Frustratingly at that time, journalists often omitted the names of scorers, whether it be a point or a goal. When the second half began,
Kerry subsequently invaded Cork's stronghold, with a brief encounter terminated in the addition of a major score, a goal to Kerry's record. This was soon after replied to with a minor for Cork, secured by Mackesy. Cork now came together well and rushed a point in good style, after which they again attacked. A certain goal was effectively neutralised by the Kerry full. The remainder of the play was very much on the Kerry side.
Kerry prevailed by 1-7 to 3 points, booking an All-Ireland semi-final with Mayo in the process. In the solitary change in personnel for the encounter against the Westerners, Denny Curran of Mitchell's was restored to the lineup. Charlie Duggan was the only one to make way. The 1903 semi-final against Mayo was played on May the 7th, 1905. Kerry breezed through the tie, putting pay to the Westerners on a 2-7 to 4-point scoreline. The other semi-final was just as one-sided, Kildare overcoming Cavan by 8 points to no score. Author and GAA historian Owen Curry believes Kerry's futuristic approach to the 1903 season was behind their qualification for the decider.
What Kerry did in 1903 changed everything, because they introduced the notion of collective training. It wasn't the collective training that people remember later on, but they gathered the players in Tralee and in Killarney. There was one player from Castle Island who cycled down to Killarney for twice a week training. They played, the Tralee boys played the Killarney boys. By the time the All-Ireland final came around, they had a pretty strong cohesive unit.
Charlie Duggan was drafted back into the Kerry side for the final. J.T. Fitzgerald also came onto the team. Con Ryan and T. Sugrue were the ones to miss out.
The greatest day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles, brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 2.
The 1903 All-Ireland home football final went ahead on July 23rd, 1905. Kerry versus Kildare was fixed for Tipperary Town. In his 1945 book, Kerry's Football Story, legendary GAA correspondent Paddy Foley told of the farcical scenes that Kerry fans encountered in their bid to get to the decider.
Thousands of cheering Kerrymen boarded the Sunday morning train at Tralee. All carriages were packed, even the guards' van, for the railway people, never anticipating such a contingent, made no adequate arrangements to cater for the huge throng. The train broke down between Ballybrack and Killarney, and a special relief train had to be sent from Tralee. There was a further long delay at Limerick Junction. The team was taken on a break to Tipperary. Hundreds of people left the train and proceeded to walk into the town. The Kerry train did not reach Tipperary town till 3:20 p.m. and the match was already in progress when the Kingdom contingent arrived in the field.
The 1970s publication Years of Glory, recalling those same train journeys, told how
the Ordinary stopped 2 miles from Tipperary, where it remained for an hour. Those on the Special fared worse. They only saw the second half.
The Kerryman newspaper slant of proceedings was even more damning at the time.
The overcrowding in the carriages in the Ordinary was well nigh unbearable. A more realistic reproduction of the Black Hole of Calcutta could not possibly be accomplished. It's a marvel that there were not many deaths from congestion and excessive heat.
Paddy Foley, who went under the moniker PF, spoke of an estimated crowd of between 12 and 15,000, with only a rope separating fans from the playing pitch. While Kildare wore their famous all-white jerseys, Kerry appeared in the red and green of county champions Mitchell's. The Kerryman newspaper documented that the referee was Pat McGrath, who would later go on to serve as secretary of the Munster Council. The aforementioned Years of Glory recalled the main moments of the first half.
Kildare were favourites, but it was Kerry who scored first. Jim O'Gorman pointing from a difficult angle. Kildare put a lot of pressure after this, but no scores resulted. It took a great save by the Kildare goalkeeper, Jack Fitzgerald, to prevent a goal on one occasion. Eventually, Kildare did improve on their shooting, Bracken and Dunn scoring 2 points before half-time.
PF noted the different styles of the teams.
Kildare hand-passing the leather on the ground. Kerry relied on overhead play, high firm fielding, punting combination. The leather fell with unfailing regularity into outstretched vice-like hands.
Into the second half, and Years of Glory continues.
Points by Charlie Duggan and Dick Fitzgerald put the Kingdom ahead, but Kildare fought back and Joyce Conlon goaled.
The Kerryman newspaper at the time went further into detail regarding that Conlon strike.
Kildare, with dashing play along the sideline, carried the ball right up to the Kerry goal, and after some smart passing, Conlon sent home. Kerry disputed the score on the grounds that the ball was out of play at the time, having gone into touch, but the referee allowed the goal.
That goal gave Kildare a 2-point advantage with 10 minutes remaining. They soon made it a 3-point game. As the Kerryman newspaper told, the Kingdom then squandered the opportunity for a goal of their own.
Like an avalanche, they swept down the field into Kildare quarters and they frightened everybody. They got a free few yards from Kildare goal, but when a splendid opportunity offered, no good resulted.
A John Thomas Fitzgerald score brought the gap back down to 2. PF goes on to tell of a hugely dramatic ending to proceedings.
2 minutes to go. Kerry attack in desperation. Up the wing they came. A Kerryman was fouled in possession and his side got an angle free. Dick Fitzgerald kicked the ball. The leather sped straight and through to the mark. It seemed as if the ball would drop on the bar, but it fell underneath. The Kildare goalman held it safely, but in doing so pulled the second leg behind the line. The goal umpire raised the fatal green flag.
It was Kildare's turn to dispute a goal, but the referee was having none of it. Kerry fans in excitement flooded the pitch. The referee attempted to clear the supporters, but blew his whistle in vain. After failing to get the match restarted, he declared Kerry the victors and All-Ireland champions. It finished Kerry 1-4, Kildare 1-3. But this was not the end of the matter. Kildare, who had protested vigorously after Kerry's goal, still refused to accept the outcome. Central Council met immediately after the match. PF reported that Kerry were not represented as they had no notice of the objection. Despite the match officials standing by their decision, a refixture was declared. Meanwhile, according to PF, the Kerry train post-match did not get back to Tralee until 4:30 a.m. Years of Glory told how the Special left at 6:15 sharp, with most Killarney people left behind. The Sentinel newspaper was not impressed with the decision to order a rematch, and for the benefit of its readers, offered up the relevant rules of the GAA, chief among them being:
the referee's decision on questions of fact connected with a match shall be final, and appeals can be made to him at once, otherwise they cannot be entertained. No appeal can be entertained against a referee's decision on a score.
PF spoke of Kerry's strenuous objections to the decision to replay and their appearance before Central Council.
Mr. London umpire adhered to his decision on the field. The referee said that with all the excitement, he did not know whether the goal was scored or not.
So, a replay was necessary, and this time, Cork was the venue. Commenting on the controversial first game, the Kerryman newspaper read:
"Bravo, Kerry! "We don't believe that a more magnificent exhibition of Gaelic football was ever witnessed. It was by pure grit and pluck Kerry turned what seemed almost certain defeat into a glorious victory."
The Kerry man was less impressed with the arrangements for supporters at the venue, which it claimed
hampered the players considerably, and we believe it militated against the chances of the Kerrymen, for the play was more than once interrupted when the odds were in their favour.
The GAA's powers that be also came in for criticism.
"The action of Central Council in ordering the match to be replayed on account of Kildare's objection to the Kerry goal will not induce greater respect for the GAA, nor more confidence in the decisions. The referee awarded the match to Kerry, and one of the most stringent rules of the association is that the referee's decision is final on all questions of fact. Central Council has neither the power to make rules nor to violate them."
Ahead of the replay, the Kerryman newspaper was bullish.
"No doubt, no pessimism now about Kerry's chances. The team from the Kingdom is going up to win, and win it will. See your countrymen play as they never played before to demonstrate the correctness of their recent victory robbed from them by the incompetent rulers. It would be a violation of good language to call them administrators connected with the GAA. We venture to say that even the picked men of two provinces, not to speak of one county, would hardly stand a chance against the improved dashing tactics of the Kerry team on Sunday."
Kerry and Kildare had well and truly captured the imagination, as much for matters off the pitch as on. PF wrote of the huge interest in the replay, which he said required special trains to be arranged from Tralee, Killarney, Listowel, Carhartt-Sivine and Castle Island. PF also told of the Killarney and Tralee groups of players training separately, then being brought together for trial matches in the two towns, as well as Listowel. Kerry made a solitary change for the replay. Jack Myers wearing number 5 instead of his Crokes clubmate Tom O'Sullivan. Years of Glory tells the tale of that replay.
"Kerry lost the toss and found themselves playing with the breeze in the first half. Dick Fitzgerald opened their account from a free. A second Kerry point followed, but then Kildare took a hand in things. For about 10 minutes, they bombarded the Kerry goal. 3 points resulted. Kerry got their game going again. Dick Fitzgerald, Dinny Curran and John Buckley scored points to leave Kerry ahead 5-3 at half-time. Kerry went further ahead when Billy Lynch pointed early in the second half. Charlie Duggan sent over Kerry's 7th point. Gorman looked sure to score a goal, but the Kildare keeper Fitzgerald brought off a wonderful save."
That near miss proved to be a turning point. Kildare kept the Kingdom scoreless to the final whistle, whilst drawing level themselves, as described by PF.
"Kennedy centred for Bracken to get a point. Kerry were still 3 points in front and appeared to take matters easily. Kildare rushed up along the wing and Conlon was loose in front of the sticks when he got possession. There was tremendous excitement when he drove under the bar to leave the scores even."
The Sentinel newspaper attributed Kerry's concession of the equalising goal to carelessness and overconfidence. The Kerryman newspaper was also less than impressed by the game-saving goal.
"Disappointment is no name for the feeling of most intense disappointment experienced. Kerry had won all over the field for 3/4 of an hour and was leading comfortably 3 minutes from time when Kildare scored a most unaccountable and lucky goal. The goal was by no means a fluky one, but the Kildare man should not have got a chance of scoring. The Kerry backs, having played a marvellously excellent game up to this, seemed suddenly to lose their heads and go to pieces. Conlon was able to get through the back division as he liked. Even the Kildare followers had to acknowledge that their idols had met their masters. Kerry proved conclusively the last day that they were superior footballers, even though luck did go against them. But they must now rise superior to luck and Kildare."
PF regaled how the ball bursting in the first half added to another dramatic occasion. Then the referee collapsed at the full-time whistle, although he recovered almost immediately. A third meeting was now required between Kerry and Kildare. Unbeknownst to the players, they were cementing the future of the association. Renowned GAA commentator Mihola Murahartig tells how that series of games was becoming a hot topic of everyday life.
"Up to then, it wasn't a big public topic, talking about football. It didn't get a lot of coverage in the newspapers. That was the only means of communication at the time. But those games caught the imagination of the public. They began to talk about them."
Ahead of game number 3, the Kerryman addressed the issue of player welfare and called on their fellow countrymen to assist the Kingdom's bid for glory.
"All the members of the Kerry team are employees. And as the days are too short now to permit of evening practice, unless their employers say give them 2 evenings off each week, they can hardly expect to be in the pink of form. There may be a few long-headed people found who will talk about the folly of any interruption to business on account of a mere football match. But we think these wiseacres can be won over. In Kildare, the members of the county team were allowed off work there for a fortnight before each of the last 2 inter-county matches.
The second replay saw the sides return to Cork, where another massive crowd turned out. GAA historian Owen Curry.
The third one drew a very big crowd by the standards, 18,000 into the Cork Athletic Grounds. That gave the GAA money, it gave it a little bit of status, people started taking it seriously.
The greatest day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
Part 3. For the closing chapter of the trilogy, Cathras Eivind's Eamon O'Neill came in for Killarney's Charlie Duggan. PF recalled how supporters were worried about Kerry's ability to play in the wet following what he described as, and I quote, the pitilessly rain which had fallen all morning. How wrong these doubting supporters were to be. It's already been mentioned that Kerry wore the green and red of Tralee Mitchells for game number 1 against Kildare. However, come game 3, the Kingdom were wearing their own famed colours. For the second replay against Kildare, Kerryman writer J.J. McSee noted that
from a corner of the field, a handful of men dressed in green and gold jerseys and trim white kickers walked onto the grass. A roar greeted them, a roar that made the nerves tingle, for there was a sting in it.
The Kerryman reported on a productive opening half for the Kingdom in that second replay.
O'Neill sent towards Dick Fitzgerald. His shot was received by J.T. Fitzgerald, who sent in a point for Kerry and the first score after 14 minutes. 4 minutes later, O'Neill came out of a tussle with a dislocated elbow joint.
Killarney's Florence O'Sullivan was called upon to replace O'Neill and the game resumed.
The ball travelled well down and Jim O'Gorman getting possession sent nicely over Kerry's second point. It seemed as if the earth shook itself with the ring of up Kerry. Shot after shot were directed to Paddy Dillon, but the Kerry custodian rose to the occasion and gave us a display which was really marvellous.
Kildare drew level but were not on par for too long.
Shortly before the whistle went for half-time, Dick Fitzgerald took the free and the ball travelled to J.T. Fitzgerald. The latter sent in the third for Kerry.
3-2 in Kerry's favour was how it stood at the break. Kerry turned the screw in the second period, but only after a narrow escape early on.
Paddy Dillon saved a magnificent shot in the centre from Kennedy. Close to the centre line, Dick Fitzgerald and Kennedy engaged in a struggle. Fitzgerald passed to Jim O'Gorman, and O'Gorman disposed of the leather over the post for the 4 point after 3.5 minutes. Gorman passed to Lynch, who sent over the fifth. Kerwin and Healy, both almost impenetrable, saved several splendid Kildare tries. From a difficult angle, Dick Fitzgerald sent over the sixth and Lynch followed with the seventh. This last score seemed to have a terrible effect upon the Kildare forwards. They simply fell to pieces and their form from this to the finish appeared to be utterly devoid of life. Shortly before full time, Dick Fitzgerald sent to Jim O'Gorman and the latter kicked over the eighth.
Finally, at the third attempt, Kerry had prevailed and seen off Kildare by 8-2. The Kerryman newspaper was bursting with pride, whilst not forgetting the vanquished.
A magnificent triumph for the Kingdom. At Tralee Station alone, 1,085 passengers booked, and taking Cathras Eivind, Listowel, Killarney and other places into consideration, there were between 3,000 and 4,000 people from Kerry at the game. The scene at the Killarney and Tralee stations on Sunday night was simply wild with enthusiasm. It is all over. The great football struggle has ended in favour of Kerry. While we are as proud as peacocks, we must say that we are not without a feeling of sympathy for the gallant Kildaremen in their defeat. It is a pity, a prominent Kerry player remarked, that we could not win the match without beating Kildare. There is no doubt that Kerry should be proud of the 17 men who represented her, and proud it is. The triumph of Kerry manhood has given the old Kingdom the top notch in the Irish counties. It was not without desperate struggles and consistent hard work that this distinction has been won.
The Sentinel too was rich in its praise of the Kingdom.
Never before in the history of the GAA has any team fought so hard and so stubbornly for the premier gift of the association. Their meeting with Kildare on 3 different occasions to decide the home final is now ancient history. But just the same, those matches will live forever in the memory of those who were fortunate enough to have witnessed the contest.
The GAA owes much to the efforts of Kerry and Kildare, a fact not lost on legendary broadcaster Mihola Muirahertig.
It was said at the time it was the biggest crowd that ever watched a sporting event in Ireland. And rugby internationals were in vogue at that time, and maybe soccer internationals as well. It got the people talking about football. It got the balladeers writing, you know, the penny pamphlets and distributing them at race meetings and fairs all over the country. That was the moment that made Gaelic football, if you like, a part of the national identity.
The Kerry man singled out the contributions of a host of Kerry players for special mention, most notably the forward division.
It affords me no little pleasure to be compelled to place the laurel wreath on the head of Dick Fitzgerald as the hero of the forwards. He is not the best in Ireland, but keeping to his play, he should have few equals by the time the next championship comes round. Words are hardly accurate to express the value of the work of the brothers Gorman. Tim is the captain. There is hardly a finer or more experienced player in Ireland. He is a well-made athlete, standing about 5 feet 8 inches and is 28 years of age. He has been playing football with the Tralee senior team since he was 17. Jim Gorman, it must be said, seemed to sparkle brighter than his twin brother on Sunday. Austin Stack is the embodiment of a great forward. He possesses fairly good pace with promise of improvement. He tackles well and kicks faultlessly. He is only 25 years of age and weighs a little over 11 stone.
Years of Glory told how
Kildare were not forgotten in the aftermath of their epic three-match series with the Kingdom, and Central Council deemed them worthy of a set of gold medals in recognition of those matches. Also, both Kerry and Kildare boards were the recipients of an extra £25 to help them with expenses.
81 years later, remember the 1903 final was not actually played until 1905? It was revealed that a 9-year-old boy aided Kerry's cause against Kildare. In the run-up to the All-Ireland final of 1986, Kerry man reporter Eamon Horan uncovered how Tralee man Billy Mullins played his part in that trilogy against Kildare. Mullins explained that the house he and his parents lived in was too big for them, and they kept 5 lodgers, including 2 Kerry players, Johnny Buckley and Denny Cassan. Mullins recalled,
"As I was going out the door with my father to the train for the replay, the old lady called me back and handed me a brown paper parcel and told me that it contained one of Johnny Buckley's football boots, which he had let fall from his bag when departing the house. Be around when he wants it."
Mullins went on to explain how he returned the boot to its owner.
"The team had gone upstairs in the hotel to tug out to go to the field. We heard fierce ructions in the room, with Johnny Buckley being abused for only bringing one football boot. I hammered on the door with the boot. It was opened and I said, 'Did anybody lose a boot?'"
Billy Mullins's brother Dan won 2 All-Irelands with Kerry, both as goalkeeper in 1913 and 1914. There was still work to do, however, with London to be faced in the final proper, in Dublin. From 1900 to 1903, there were home and away All-Ireland finals, whereby the home All-Ireland winners would each year play London. Florence O'Sullivan, a used sub in the second replay against Kildare, started against London. He took over from Eamon O'Neill, whom he had replaced against Kildare due to injury. The first period of that Kerry-London decider saw the Kingdom excel.
From the throw-in, Kerry broke away. Myers received from Jay Fitzgerald, who sent the leather with a flying kick over the crossbar. London Irish dribbled along effectively, and a free gave them a substantial advantage, but Kerwin frustrated, and whilst heading a rush along touch, dislocated his knee, which had been injured in some previous matches in which he had played. He was a great loss to Kerry, for as it is well known, Kerwin is the best back to be found in Ireland. A good kick to the centre of the field was returned by Cassan, and J.T. Fitzgerald finished up with a clever point for Kerry. J.D. Fitzgerald added another minor for Kerry, and Dick Fitzgerald repeated 2 minutes later. Myers took a free for Kerry and brought off a minor.
Kerry, who registered 8 points of their own, had kept London scoreless in that opening half. London had chances of their own, but failed to avail of each one of them. The side shared 6 points in the second half, with the match finishing 11-3. The treatment of the Kerry players in the final was questionable.
During the game, the play was of particular rough character and several of the Kerry players had to retire from the field, some of them very badly hurt owing to the tactics of those on the opposition side. During the first half, Kerwin had to retire, which we need scarcely mention was a severe loss to Kerry. However, the boys from the Kingdom were not a bit disheartened. J. During the second half, Myers, Killarney and Conhealy Tralee were badly hurt, Myers having to retire.
Did you know the captain of the defeated London team was a certain Sam Maguire? The Kerry Association in Dublin would not be formed for nearly another half century. However, even in the 1900s, the bond between exiled Kerrymen and the team of their birthplace was evident. The Kerryman newspaper recalled how on the night of the Kerry versus London final,
the Kerrymen, resident in Dublin, entertained the Kerry team and their friends at a banquet. There were present men from every part of the county, from Dingle to Rathmore and Kinmare to Tarbert, all to do honour to the famous Kerry 17. The spacious ball was full to overflowing, and at times it was hard to believe we were a couple of hundred miles from our native Kerry hills.
Joe Murhurthick is co-author of Kerry football book Princes of Pigskin. He says the success of the 1903 campaign can be traced back to the first year of the 20th century.
The real kind of defining point and the defining thing that happened to reinvigorate Kerry football was the reforming of the John Mitchell's club. That came out of a famous meeting that was held in Tralee in 1900, where some key figures in Kerry football history and subsequent Kerry football history were there. Austin Stack convened the meeting. Apart from being well known for his patriotism in later years, he was also a great footballer and was on two All-Ireland teams. He was at the meeting. Maurice McCarthy was there. Teddy O'Gorman, Denny Curran and a few more. They all went on to win All-Irelands in 1903, but they had a meeting in the National League rooms in the Mall in Tralee, and out of that, the Mitchells Club was reformed and put on a sounder footing, and within a couple of years, Kerry were winning Munster Championships, and then they won that first All-Ireland in 1903. For the first five All-Ireland winning teams that you have had, would have had in Kerry from 1903 to 1914, there would have been a huge John Mitchell's influence. There would have been a big Killarney influence as well from the likes of Dick Fitzgerald, and they were the two main centres of population, so they would give most players to the team. But the Mitchell's influence was huge at the start.
November 12, 1905 goes down in the history books as the date on which Kerry won its inaugural All-Ireland Senior Football Crown. PF's book, Kerry's Football Story, recalled those heroes of the 1903 campaign.
Goalkeeper Paddy Dillon, the eagle-eyed man of sure foot, who disdained fielding flying balls as they sped to the target, he lashed or punched them clear. The magnificent backs, round the middle, Dan McCarthy, Kerry's first aeroplane, and the strong, fast men who feared nothing. Tim Gorman and his twin brother Jim, football machines, most delightful players to watch. The fleet, John Thomas Fitzgerald. Sturdy Cassan, stocky Charlie Duggan of the cannon shot. And pivot of the attack, a tall, lanky lad, perfect feet and hands, the most deadly marksman of all time, Dick Fitzgerald.
Up Kerry, might and main, three times for green and gold, for our boys both brave and bold, high hooray, up Kerry once again. Never shall our grand old game lose in prestige or in fame, while the gallant sons of Kerry shall remain. Theirs to keep the old flag flying, all imported games decrying, cheered along by Kerry's proud refrain. Hooray, up Kerry, sing we proudly. Hooray, up Kerry, might and main. Three times for green and gold, for our boys both brave and bold. Hi, hooray, up Kerry once again.
You've been listening to The Greatest Day, a 36-part series documenting the story of Kerry's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories. The Greatest Day was presented by John Drummy, written by Joe O'Mahony, and researched and produced by the Radio Kerry Sports team. This programme was made with the support of the Sound and Vision Broadcast Funding Scheme, a BCI initiative.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles, brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Next week on The Greatest Day.
Kerry have now refused to accept the walkover and have offered to play Cork.
Once the sides took to the field, Kerry taught their great rivals a footballing lesson.
Dempsey at Cork goal was most faultly, and the major score went down to Kerry.
He would be recognised as a real standout figure in Kerry football. purely maybe by virtue of the fact that he wasn't a Kerry man at all.
The Kingdom were to receive the shock of their lives in the provincial final.
Approaching a big game, our employers would allow us to leave work early on Tuesday and Friday evenings. The team then travelled to Killarney, where the probables played the possibles. This was as much collective training as we did.
A 5-2 victory meant Austin Stack was the second Kerry captain of an All-Ireland winning team.
They had no stretcher, so they took a door off the dressing room and then they marched into the hospital.